Hi, it's Bob from Royal Spa. Soaking in a hot tub full of Epsom salts is the absolute best way to minimize everyday aches and pains. And we know all about Epsom salts at Royal Spa. Royal Spa hot tubs are the only hot tubs on the market that can safely and effectively use Epsom salts. Made right here in Indiana, Royal Spa hot tubs are the highest quality hot tubs on the market. Visit any one of our three Indianapolis locations or visit royalspa.com.
Ah, Royal Spa.
The NFL draft is upon us. It takes place on Thursday. As of now, the Colts tentatively scheduled to draft 15th overall. We will talk to Stephen Holder about the prospects of them selecting in that situation, as well as his latest on Jim Irsay, as Stephen joins us now, as he is kind enough to do each and every week. You can read his work, of course, at ESPN.com. Stephen, I am going to lead off with a non-football-related trivia question for you and put you on the spot. Fair?
Okay. My favorite kind of question.
That's right.
Go ahead.
And obviously you were not listening to the program before you came on, because I said, I wonder if Stephen knows this, and you would have Googled it by now and know the answer. But okay. We've just played the Village People. You're familiar with the Village People, YMCA, the song for which they're most known. Their lead singer was the Sailor, okay? Victor Willis, I believe his name. And Victor Willis, one time I just got curious, and I thought, I wonder what the background is on this fella. Like, how long did it take him to leave the Navy to join the group? How exactly did he meet the construction worker? And then I learned that Victor Willis himself was already a very accomplished entertainer and singer, actor, other such areas. And when on the set of The Wiz, which was something he was a part of, he met his soon-to-be wife, who he would later divorce, and his wife would go on to a bigger, more prominent marriage and career. Do you know the name of the woman that Victor Willis, the lead singer of Village People, was married to during the time of Macho Man and the YMCA?
I don't, but I feel like I should. It feels like it might be somebody obvious, and I'm not thinking about it.
And I know this is going to surprise people, but my understanding is both the construction worker and the cop were very jealous of his relationship. Okay, so...
I don't know. I really don't know who it is.
Okay.
But I'm dying to know now.
During the time of all of that hoopla around the Village People, he was married to a woman who he would divorce that would later get engaged to Ahmad Rashad. And she was known as Felicia Rashad, who, of course, played played Claire Huxtable on The
Claire,
Cosby Show.
Claire freaking Huxtable?
Yes.
Now, okay.
So how about this? Then, Stephen... The other night, during a bout of insomnia, I'm flipping the channels, and my choices are between Barney Miller or an episode of The Cosby Show, and I go with The Cosby Show, and it was from 1988, so like a couple of years, probably like season 4 of The Cosby Show, and then I get curious, and I looked it up, and at the time of the taping of the episode that I was watching, Bill Cosby was 48, and Felicia Rashad was 39 years old, and I've never felt more old in my life.
That's crazy.
Isn't it?
I mean, when I was watching The Cosby Show, it always kind of felt like, oh, they're easily like, you know, 55 years
correct,
old.
Correct, right? Like they've got this nice brownstone in Brooklyn and everything else. I mean, today a 39-year-old living in that brownstone in Brooklyn has 19 roommates. I mean, come on, right?
Well, or you live in the basement apartment.
Correct. Right? So, that is exactly correct.
With my brother's first apartment in New York, when he moved there right out of college, was a basement apartment in the Bronx, okay? So, and I know people in Indiana probably have no idea what the hell that even means, but it had a window, so it was actually okay, but it was literally a basement apartment.
So it had a window that was like eye level and you could see the street?
It was like below street level. So you got that step, those three or four steps down, and you got the steps up to the front door, you know what I mean? You know, one of those brownstone type setups. So yeah, if you envision Sesame Street, you got the walk up, but then there's a, you know, that stoop on Sesame Street, same setup, but then you've got three or four steps down. So like everybody I know who went to New York, that was like your first apartment.
Totally. Well, when I lived in New York, the apartment that I had, you open the main like foyer, and there was my studio and then another studio to the left with a shared bathroom and shower in the middle.
All right. That is the true New York experience right there, buddy.
Totally.
I will say, aside from all of that, despite all of that, which is effectively awful, right? No one wants to live like that. I actually am jealous of my brother that he got that experience in life at like 22 years old,
Steven,
in the city with not a care in the world.
I
never got that opportunity, and like I was so jealous when I would go visit.
I interned at MTV Networks in New York City at the age of 21 years old and lived by myself in Greenwich Village, New York City, and there is no sub-year period, like under a one-year period. There is no period of my life that was more influential on me. No question. I loved every single minute of it.
It's the best.
It is.
It's the best.
I loved every single minute of it.
It's not for everybody. You know, some people hate New York. My wife hates New York. She doesn't even want to go. I got family there. But I love it. It is exactly right. It is a place that can really shape you and form you. And, you know, look, I love it. And I get it. I get the New York experience. So anyway, I don't know how we got on that topic, but now you know something about me.
Steven, you had a chance to talk to Jim Irsay. I know that, you know, your article, Colts owner Jim Irsay, won't be in draft room amid recovery. Has gotten a lot of, obviously, conversation, but let's carry that on here on the airwaves. You talked to Irsay. How did he sound, first off? And if you could, was that the first time that you have spoken with him since his name has been in so many rumors dating back to the end of the season?
Yes, actually, it is the first time I've spoken to him. Outside of a voice message that I had gotten some weeks back, but we had not had any actual conversation. So the first time, frankly, in the calendar year 2024 that I have spoken to him. Now, he has certainly been in contact with people much more important than me, but, you know, in terms of where I sit, yes, this was the first time. In terms of how he sounded, you know, I mean, he sounded like himself. I would say that, you know, he was, I thought it was very telling just when we talked about, you know, kind of his expectations for the season, for example. He's already, you know, making big proclamations, right? That, you know, Anthony Richardson has only scratched the surface and we've never seen what this guy can do. We've only scratched the surface of the Anthony Richardson era, he said. You know, so he's already giving Anthony Richardson an era after four games, which is fine, right? I love Anthony Richardson. So that's typical Jim Irsay. I think the other thing I would point out is I asked him, look, I know how much you love the draft, just as a being present, I guess, during the draft. He loves the strategy. He loves the, you know, the anxious moments. He loves to be able to welcome the draft picks on the telephone right after the picks are made, for example. So all of that is just really something he really looks forward to. And I asked him how much he'd miss that. And it is something that he will definitely miss, but he's going to be dialed in virtually by Zoom or some other platform. And he will be dialed in the whole time to the draft, and will even have the chance to even talk to the prospects on the phone, he said. So, you know, he said it will be pretty much business as usual. And that's something that he did stress, is that things are moving along like normal, you know, his physical absence notwithstanding. So the last thing I would say on that note is in recent years, Jim Irsay has not been as present at Colts headquarters anyway. He has not been there certainly on a daily basis, not at all. He has been all over the place, right? He likes to hang out in California for weeks at a time in the off season, you know? So this is not that different, but certainly we are at a place now where at least, you know, he is able to have exchanges and communicate and so forth. Whereas before, he was not able to play a role such as that, based on my understanding earlier this year when he was not in the best of health. So anyway, that's the update.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Stephen Holder of ESPN.com is our guest. Steven, I know I'm asking you to look into a crystal ball here, but in terms of, you know, his vocal strength and in talking with him and how he sounds, do you envision him being capable of this? And B, is this something you think again, looking to a crystal ball, the Colts would do. That is to say that maybe it's a teleconference or something that is either digital or over the phone, where he would still be able to speak on what the Colts did post-draft.
So I actually don't think it's completely off the table. He made like a very quick passing reference to it, but it wasn't like, hey, that's going to happen. It was like, hey, who knows? Maybe I'll be able to talk to you guys. I have no idea if it's going to happen. And, you know, he says a lot of things in passing that don't necessarily transpire. Sure. So, but no, it's I'm actually not having to use a crystal ball because he did kind of make reference to it, but I would not characterize it as a promise as much as like, we'll see, you know? So we, you know, if that does happen, I think that would be very welcome. And I know, I'd say this, I know that's an opportunity that he very much looks forward to. There are times after the draft where, you know, we think the dust has settled and it's all said and done. And nope, the day's not over. Jim Mercy hasn't been in the room yet. And sure enough, he'll show up. So I don't think he's missed an opportunity, you know, in my time covering the Colts, which is a decade now. So it is something that's very important to him. And if there's a way to do it, and he can convince the powers that be to facilitate it, then I think it could happen. We'll see.
Steven, I want to ask for a clarification because I was a little confused by this. And I know that since your interview, I believe Irsay has done another as well. I think Chap did talk to him, but I want to make sure that I'm not blending two different timelines together. Okay.
Right.
And maybe this isn't even important. I don't know. I feel like it is, and I'll explain why. In your article, it appears as though that Irsay wanted to clarify that the medical episodes he was having in December and the reason that he was gone for so long was because of an issue with his leg that led to a surgery, or that he had to get taken care of, and that since then he's had another surgery, a back surgery. But am I correct in saying, or did I misunderstand it, that he was essentially saying, yes, I'm guilty of some things in the past, but don't draw the conclusion that that's what I was involved with in December, because that's erroneous. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
It's a little bit. That's a little bit right. I think what he's actually doing is not really specifying anything. That's the problem. You know, he's not saying, at least to me, I guess in reading the conversation with Mike Chappell, like I guess he was more direct in talking about the actual potential overdose. With me, I said to him, I said, look, you know, people have asked a lot of questions of me, of others, just in generally. And I said, you know, they're asking because they're concerned about you, Jim. And I said, you know, I would love for you to address the questions that are out there. You know, you're trying to be delicate, right?
Sure.
And his response to that question was, well, you know, look, I have some stuff in my past, so, you know, people will draw a lot of conclusions based on that, but that's not what it is. But it's not a really direct answer. It certainly doesn't say, well, what did happen?
Well, the only reason I bring it up is because, and I understand, and I respect and appreciate
I want to do one other thing because it is confusing. You are correct. Here's what's confusing. The timeline in terms of the back/leg surgery, I feel like I'm talking about Jonathan Taylor's injuries again here. But anyway, in terms of what's going on with him now and his latest surgery, that is more recent to my understanding. That is my understanding of that. Like, that happened more recently, even subsequent to the respiratory illness, I believe. But he was not clear on the timeline on how all of that happened or when all of it happened. And I think part of the reason he wasn't clear is because there are some questions that maybe he doesn't want to answer, I think. You know,
I can respect that, right?
Right.
But I mean, we've heard the 911 call, and we heard what was being described as the distress he was in, and it was not leg related.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
no, for sure. That's why I'm saying this surgery situation that he's had, my understanding of that is that it's more recent, and everything points to that, right? But he's being vague, probably intentionally so, and I guess I expected that, but it is a little bit difficult to articulate, you know, what he's trying to say because he's being vague, I guess.
Is there any chance, Stephen Holder, moving towards the draft now, okay, and I appreciate the clarification and discussion there.
Yep.
I threw this out last week, and I want you to talk me off of this subject matter unless you think that it's worth keeping open, okay? But I do believe this, okay. Stephen. I would have said 0% chance. You and I talk a lot about this. You know, you get stuff where people start sending you stuff that their neighbor's mailman's, you know, next door neighbor's prom date's brother heard, right?
Right.
And more often than not, you go, okay, that's cool. And then you start hearing it more where you're like, you know what? I wonder if there is something to this. I went from 0% chance of this on my response to now simply saying that I think it's a 5 to 10% chance. Okay, maybe 20. If Jim Irsay has any involvement at all in the draft, and he's the owner, and if he is still around, and even if he's not in the war room, he is a sentimental guy, and the horseshoe matters to him, and the heritage and the legacy and the history of it and storylines matter to him. And it just so happens that all of those would coincide with a guy who is an absolute difference maker potentially for the Colts in the position that they most need it. Do you think there is the remote possibility that Irsay says to Chris Ballard, if there's a way for you to swing this year's pick and a package of picks from later years to move up to take Marvin Harrison Jr., I want you to do it? How outlandish is that?
I don't think if it happens, right, which I think is a minuscule possibility.
Okay.
If it happened, I don't think it would play out that way. Here's what I think. I think the idea would have to be Chris Ballard's, and then Jim Irsay would put him over the top. Like, in other words, so go back to 2020. Now, this is a much, much different scenario, okay? Completely on a different planet, but it speaks to what I'm talking about. So they're looking at Jonathan Taylor. They had already picked Michael Pittman Jr. And then a few picks later, here's Jonathan Taylor's sitting there and he's falling a little bit. And they have the opportunity to trade up and get him. And they have been eyeballing him for months, right? And you can hear in the video that was released by the team, you hear Jim Irsay say to Chris Ballard, "Chris, I mean, you've been talking about him for months. What are you doing? Go get him." And because they were debating it. And it wasn't so much him telling him what to do. It was him saying, "Dude, just do it. You said you love him. Just go do it," right? So I think Chris in particular is not one to really like to give up future picks. That's not his thing. We know that. You know, Mr. I like them picks, right? He wants more, not fewer picks. So he sometimes has to be talked into those situations because his inclination is to go the other way. His inclination is not to trade up, it's to trade back. So, but again, I don't know that Jim Irsay would be that direct. It's not been his nature in the past. The Jeff Saturday situation notwithstanding, right? I don't know, temporary insanity. I don't know what happened there, but that being said, that is not his way. It is not his history. He generally doesn't function that way. But I think if there is sort of a tie in the Senate, you know, so to speak, Jim Irsay is the guy who's the vice president who can sit there and make the tie-breaking vote. You know, so I don't know if anybody paid attention in civics, but I think that's how that works.
Colts beat writer for ESPN.com, Stephen Holder, nice enough to take some time with us. Stephen, are we at a point in the process for the Colts where, for example, if they're keeping the pick at 15, if Brock Bowers is there, if Tyrion Arnold is there, if Brian Thomas Jr., who by all accounts is going to be there, is there? Do we have any firm footing on, yeah, that's a can't-miss guy for them that matches up with their needs, their wants? There's not a ton of debate there. Do we have any clarity on 2, 3, maybe 4 guys that fit that mold if they keep the pick?
Well, I think just based on what we know of their profile of player. Now that's different than saying, hey, I specifically heard they like this guy, right?
Right.
That's not what we're saying. And they usually do a very good job of keeping a lid on that.
Fort Knox,
now,
for sure. Yeah.
Last year was a little easier because it was like, okay, which quarterback, right? So, but anyhow, this is different because there's not that one position. But I think you can kind of profile what kind of player they like. Like, for example, Quinyon Mitchell at cornerback, the Toledo cornerback. I mean, he's a guy who people point to as a good fit for the Colts because, you know, he gives them kind of he's long and gives them kind of the build that they like. And Chris Ballard is very adamant about that. Like, I think he said once that, like, he won't draft a corner under 5'10". Like, he just will not do it. Or maybe under 5'11", I think. I can't recall.
Speaking of those corners, Steven, do you read into any of what he said about, I mean, I get it, it's lying season, what's he going to say? Oh, our corners are terrible. Like, that we need to get them out of town and find new guys. That's not what he's going to say. But, like, does that do anything other than he's being a voice of the team, talking up his guys?
So I've wondered about that, and I actually think it. I think what he says there does matter a little bit, and here's why. And so, to be specific, what we're talking about is, he said on Friday during his press conference that he actually has he thinks very highly of that secondary. He doesn't think that in year two for some of those guys that the performance will be the same. They also, in his defense, they also had just a ridiculous slew of injuries that you imagine will not repeat itself. But that being said, the performance wasn't great. Look, they had a historic number of sacks last season, and they still, I think, were 20th in opposing quarterback QBR. Well, that has to reflect on the secondary somewhat, right? I mean, like, come on. So I think, you know, look, but here's why I do pay it some heed, because he's done this before. You know, and he made an example of that, or he offered an example on Friday by talking about our criticisms of the offensive line coming out of the 2022 season, right? You know, here's Matt Ryan and company getting beat up repeatedly because the offensive line was just getting overpowered. And coming out of that season, he said, no, we're going to give these guys a second chance and a new lease on life. And to their credit, they stepped up and had a really good season last year. Now, I made this argument with J&V last night, and I'll make it here again. The difference is that group had past success, that offensive line. That unit was very highly drafted, most of those guys. You know, that is a little different scenario than you have in the secondary, where in some cases you have undrafted prospects, or if they are drafted, like in the case of, you know, Juju Brents, you don't have any history. I mean, he played last year, but, like, he didn't play all that great. He had some good, some bad. This is not Anthony Richardson, who, yes, very limited time in the lineup, but when he played, it was fantastic, right? So I think they're taking a little more of a leap here. And I know that's a very long answer, but I think he has said this enough times now that there is certainly a sense that, like, okay, he might actually believe this. And he has a history of doing this before. So I don't think we can discount it. The question is he right?
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Steven, in terms of, like, you talk about, like, corner, right? And I mean, obviously we know that that's an area of need. But I keep going back to this. If Bowers is available, for those that are unfamiliar, we're talking about the tight end from Georgia who appears to be the best yard after catch tight end in the draft. And that's, you look at teams that have had deep success, you know, you got to have a guy like that, it would seem. In terms of Bowers, if he is on the board when they're on the clock at 15, is there any way they don't take him?
I think there is an argument for not taking him. I'm just devil's advocate, right? Okay, just devil's advocate. And the argument is that tight ends generally are not considered a premium position. Now, yes, I know the argument there is, okay, Chris Ballard took a guard at number 6 overall, but Quentin Nelson is easily the best guard in football and is a generational player. So all I'm saying is if you ask me a question, like what's the argument for not doing it? Well, that would be the argument. Now, and then just generally, you know, tight ends are, they're almost kind of an accessory, you know what I mean? Generally speaking. Now, here's the other side of that coin, and I think this is critical. If the Colts make their evaluation and they see Brock Bowers as a guy who can be transcendent, well, then make the pick. That's fine. And here's why. Not only the evaluation, but also because if Shane Steichen's on board and he says, look, I can do some things with this guy that I can't do with anybody else, well, I'm in. Do it. And also, that's where I think this could be a little bit of a unique situation. Shane Steichen, I think, deserves the benefit of the doubt. You know, if you give him a high-end weapon, he can do a lot with it. Again, generally, I'm kind of agnostic on tight ends that early in the draft. You know, there's only a handful that go that high. They just generally do not get picked that early. But again, if we're talking about a unique situation, he's clearly a unique player, then I'm okay with it. And I guess we'll see whether they are too.
Okay, so I'm looking right here. The Colts have one pick in each of 7 rounds, correct? They have 7 overall picks as of right now, correct?
Right, correct.
Okay. This has to be some sort of a prop bet, right? So don't let that guy for, was it the Raptors? Jontay Porter, don't let him know about this, okay? if you had to prop bet it, Steven, with 7 picks, which side of the ball are the majority of picks?
Okay, good question. Now, I want to say, if my bosses are listening, we have a company policy. I am not allowed to bet on the NFL. So I want to be clear. We're just talking here.
Correct. Understood. Sorry about the need for this.
I'm actually serious, but I'm,
no,
but
I get
I'm
it.
Kidding. No one cares. I'm just kidding. So anyway, good question. I would say,
Or do they take a special teams specialist like in 7 and then balance it where it's 3-3-1?
Nah. I mean, look, they're not going to look at it that way in terms of like, do we need more offense?
No, defense? I get it. I get it.
They're not. But I think if we had to have the conversation, I feel like it's probably tilted a little more to defense. Just because I think your high end, let me see. They have some high end talent on offense. They have some on defense too. I mean, you know, DeForest Buckner is a ridiculous player, obviously. But I think on offense, you have, they also have a lot of investment on offense. Look, you have the 4th overall pick, which is an investment. You have, you know, the offensive line, major investment there, right? Your top receiver, Michael Pittman, $23 million a year, right? I mean, you have Jonathan Taylor. I mean, you have a lot of high-end talent over there, and I think you have some good talent on defense. In a couple cases, you have some high-end talent there as well, but I think you could use more of it. So we'll see. I mean, that's just a very hypothetical thing, but that's the way I would sort of forecast it as we sit here right now.
So you think over under 7.5 total picks made? You think he's trading back, adding assets, or you think he's staying put? What do you think?
I think at some point you probably get a trade back, and it may not be in the first round.
Sure.
That's the other thing. You know, keep in mind, I mean, you could do it in the 3rd round and pick up a couple of 5th rounders or something, you know, and that's, there's value in that. I mean, and especially for the Colts, I know it's not sexy, but keep in mind, if you're a fan, think long-term. I mean, the Colts, they really do a good job on the back half of the draft. I got to give them a lot of credit. They do a good job of finding talent in the middle rounds and even the late rounds. And honestly, that's often the difference between a team that drafts well and a team that doesn't, because the bottom third of your roster is going to be those guys. And those are the guys that got to play when your starters get hurt. If those guys suck, your team's going to suck.
And also, as you extend guys and start front-loading salaries, you got to have minimum wage guys that are able to play for you.
100%. So, look, it's like any business, you know. It all has to fit together. There's a plan. There's a formula. Look, if the bottom third of your roster is a disaster, you're going to have problems. You've got to have depth, and the depth comes from those middle and late rounds.
OK, Okay, Stephen, last thing, and I'm going to do this in football language because this is the way that, you know, I find this amusing. So I'm going to give you my pick, right? They asked us at the station to each predict who the Colts are going to take. And I'm going to give you the guy that I said, and then I want you to grade my guess, and here's how we're going to grade it. We're not going to go A through F. That's lame, right? You're going to gauge the validity of my guess on the Colts draft pick by telling me the solidarity of the guess of an NFL, equating it to an NFL quarterback. So in other words, if I give you the guess that is a perfect, perfect guess, then you'd say, oh, that's a Patrick Mahomes level guess. If I give you one that is a disaster, you would go, no, that guess is like Zach Wilson. Like, there's just no chance. It has no chance, right? Okay, if I give you one that you're like, it's passable, you'd be like, okay, that's Kirk Cousins, okay? Yeah. My prediction, assuming that the Colts stay at 15, my prediction, Brian Thomas Jr., wide receiver, LSU, that would equate to what quarterback in terms of how strong a prediction that is?
I would say... How about Trevor Lawrence?
Okay.
Which is like, could be good, but you got to catch him on the right day. You know?
Fair.
Like, it could be great, right? He could go upset, you know, go get an upset in the playoffs, or it could be, you know, God, what happened to this guy? So I don't know. Well, somewhere in that, you know.
Hey, let me remind you, Trevor Lawrence did make a throw in Lucas Oil Stadium that led one Stephen Holder to say, holy cow, look at that throw, right?
Oh, no question. There's no question. He's done that multiple times. That is definitely accurate.
So, see? Yeah. Perfect pick. Perfect pick. Brian Thomas Jr., LSU.
Okay, I don't know where we got to perfect, but okay.
Well, you believe you me, if that's who they end up picking, then drive by Friday because you're going to see me when I'm standing on top of Monument Circle shouting it from the mountaintops. I'll be on top of the monument with Miss Liberty yelling it out for everybody.
And your hard hat.
That's right. It will not be on the north side because they haven't had the steps finished yet. All right, Stephen, we appreciate the time as always.
All right, guys. Talk soon.
Stephen Holder of ESPN.com.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Doesn't seem like long ago, I guess it really wasn't, that our next guest joined us at the Indiana Convention Center as part of the NFL Scouting Combine. He, of course, covering the Jaguars down in Jacksonville. For Jaguars.com, J.R. Shadrick joins us on the program. And J.P., who I can't read my own writing. I want to begin with this. Jags selecting, and let's just assume tentative, right? Because we know that teams can move around a little bit, maybe move up, move down. But selecting 17th and then again at 48, I kind of get the feeling that Jacksonville's in the same position as Indianapolis, and that is that they're going to be tempted by offensive firepower to build around their franchise quarterback. But I don't know the more esoteric needs of Jacksonville. Where do things seem to be trending for them after the combine at 17?
Yeah, first of all, good afternoon. Good to be back with you. And, you know, they did a lot of work in free agency, and, you know, they got a veteran defensive tackle in Eric Armstead to come in. They got a veteran center in Mitch Morse. They plugged some holes on the offensive line. They re-signed the left guard. They extended the right guard and Brandon Sheriff. They got a couple of veteran defensive backs, one that can play safety, another that's a corner. But they don't necessarily have that other side starting corner, CB1, if you will. So for me, I think that's probably the priority going into the draft, is they need somebody who can go out there, I think, and play on the outside and in a new defense. They play a lot of press man. At least that's the idea of this new defense. What does that really feel like? So for me, yeah, offensive firepower is great. They feel like they have some of that as well already. They got Gabe Davis in to fill that spot of Ridley, and they got the other veteran players that they have at wide receiver and at tight end. But for me, at least right now, a guy who can start right away, a corner, is probably the priority. Next on my list, personally, would be an offensive tackle, because they're going into the final year of the left tackle Cam Robinson, the final year of the swing tackle Walker Little. What does the future hold there? If you have a guy you feel like can start either right or left tackle, you've got Anton Harrison on the other side. So do they move up? Fans want to move up and get a wide receiver. That's the flashy play. But for the long-term stability, I think it's either a corner or an offensive lineman, in my opinion.
J.P. Shadrick is our guest, Jaguars.com. J.P., when I look at their receiving core, I think it's solid. Zay Jones, Christian Kirk, you mentioned the acquisition of Gabe Davis. From my seat from afar, neither of those three are wide receiver ones. I think they're a high-level collection of wide receiver twos. And, you know, Zay Jones at his best day is a very, very good wide receiver. With Doug Peterson's offense, with the mindset of that war room, because I'm with you, defense is clearly a need, and solidifying their cornerback room is probably priority number one. But do they feel like they need a wide receiver one in a perfect world for what Trevor Lawrence is and what Doug Peterson wants out of this group? Or is it, no, Lawrence is good, he will elevate these wide receivers to the point that a collection of twos is perfectly fine?
Yeah, I think they've been pretty consistent with the idea that they don't necessarily need a wide receiver one, like that big. Now, if he's there and he's on your team, that's great. Obviously, you don't turn that down if he's available. But they can go out with so-called wide receiver twos, a group of them, if they know where they're going. And they're good enough to get there consistently. And they're smart enough to play in this offense and change and run different routes and know everybody's role. That's part of this situation too. They need high football IQ wide receivers and skilled players that are able to adjust on the fly, that aren't overblown with all the information and can adjust. And that's what their ideal offensive weapon, I think, is. So that's why, at least in my gut, it would take a lot for them to really move up to get a receiver, because they feel like they can go play right now with the guys they have. And they got the tight end Evan Ingram, who really acts as a fourth receiver, and they've got weapons that they can go play with. So, you know, why give up all that equity to go up and get a guy when you don't necessarily need that? Would you love to have it? Sure, it's great, but he's got to be the right guy. It's not just, you know, speed and ability. Yes, those are very important, but it's, you know, how does he fit in this offense? How can he adjust with the quarterback? Is he smart enough to be able to adjust on the fly and have that IQ to go with it? That's a big piece of what they're trying to get done here.
Our guest is J.P. Shadrick. We're talking about the Jacksonville Jaguars. J.P., you know, every year there's a team in the NFL that's like the sexy, trendy, this is the next step forward franchise. It's been the Chargers for like 15 straight years. But, you know, last year the Jaguars joined in that conversation for certain. And I know they were injured and there were a lot of things that went against them. That probably shifts now to Houston, and the Texans now become the team that everybody kind of keeps an eye on, maybe Detroit. Is that advantage Jacksonville? I know that health was an issue. But is this team, in terms of its psyche, one that is better off kind of without that spotlight on them as opposed to one that everybody was paying to? Did that pressure get to them a year ago?
Yeah, I don't know if it was necessarily the pressure, right? I mean, they got to 8-3, and they were in first place by a couple games at that point. Yeah, the injuries started to mount up. You know, but there were some things behind the scenes early in that season. They were winning some games, but the defense wasn't necessarily great. Obviously, they made changes on the coaching staff on that side of the ball after the year. And, you know, I don't know if it was necessarily the pressure. I think there was a lot of things internally, and then all of a sudden the injuries piled on top of that. And once that ball started rolling downhill, Houston got hot, Jaguars weren't, and it was all she wrote. And really all it took was just one win. They just couldn't figure it out. You know, in the last week of that season and couldn't get it done. So the pressure, okay, they didn't have any pressure 2 years ago because they were so far out of four games back and just went on some crazy run that you'll never be able to replicate again with all these comeback wins in the regular season to even get to the playoffs. So, I mean, they've proven what they are. I mean, they're a 9-win team, and they've done it two different ways the last 2 years. They did it coming back 2 years ago. And they did it collapsing last year. So can the ball bounce their way a little bit more and get to 11 wins? Probably. Could it go the other way and go down to 7 wins? Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where they are right now. So can they fill enough holes and stay healthy enough to get to that 11-win spot? That's the big question. And I don't know necessarily if it's, you know, spotlight or lack thereof. The spotlight's going to be there. That's just what they are. I mean, they've already re-signed big money contracts to Josh Allen, of course, outside linebacker. A quarterback deal at some point could be coming. I think they're still talking. So, hey, you start paying that kind of money to a quarterback and a defensive end and all these big-name players, the spotlight's going to be on you, whether you're in first place or last place. So get ready, because the expectations will come with that.
From down in Jacksonville, J.P. Shadrick is our guest. J.P., there's a world in a scenario where both the Jaguars and the Colts are coveting cornerback with their first-round pick. Both of them have seen mocked to them the likes of Tyron Arnold or Quinyon Mitchell, depending on where you look at things. An ESPN mock I saw the other day had Nate Wiggins to Jacksonville out of Clemson at 17. There's just two spots separating these divisional rivals. When you're looking at their war room and as they're measuring things up, could there be a need for them? There's other teams that need corner, sure, but could there be a need for them to be like, you know what? The Colts also need to solidify their cornerback room, and we don't want to be playing against that guy for the next 5 years. We need to move up to get ahead of them.
Yeah, I mean, it really kind of depends on how far, right? I mean, I don't see them moving into the top 10 for it. That's going to cost you a whole lot. And
let's say 14 with the Saints, just for the sake of argument, in this hypothetical scenario.
That's three spots, right? I mean, that's in that scenario, okay, maybe, if you have a guy that you really is head and shoulders above the other two or three guys that we've talked about, okay, maybe you make that move and go get it and just get it done with. Now, I mean, you got to make sure that guy's right, though. I mean, if you're going to start giving up equity, even though it's only three spots up, you better make darn sure he's the perfect fit for you. And, you know, that's a possibility, I think, for both sides, right? Because you know the Jaguars are going to need it. Colts might have to do that if they want to jump up and feel like there's one guy that's really standing out for the Jaguars and vice versa. So, but Trent Baalke's not afraid now. The GM of the Jaguars will pull the trigger on a trade in mid-draft multiple times. But these are a little different. When you're moving up in the first round, those become very costly very quick. He's more apt to do something like that, you know, on day two and move up in the second round, like trade a couple of third, fourth-round picks to move up earlier in the second round to do that. We've seen that multiple times in his tenure here. But the first-round trade up, they've traded back into the first round at the bottom half, which is not as expensive. They've done that a couple times, in fact. But this high, I mean, it's going to have to be something that they feel like is a game changer. And well, I guess we'll find out Thursday, because we really haven't seen that type of trade from Trent Baalke yet.
JP, it's really interesting, is it not, the AFC South? Because for years, you know, Tennessee's obviously been solid, and they're probably the one that now has the most catching up to do. To me, and I realize you're covering the Jaguars for Jaguars.com, and so you're not focusing on Houston and Indianapolis, but we all have to be aware of what the others are doing just to be able to adequately cover it, right? And it does feel like, from my standpoint, Indianapolis, Jacksonville, and Houston are kind of on even footing in terms of trying to be the one to separate themselves. But am I being biased from an Indianapolis lens there? And in fact, are the Colts a tick behind Houston and Jacksonville? You see it or handicap it how?
You know, I think the unknown in Indy is the quarterback situation. Is Richardson going to be back and healthy and ready and the guy that they feel like he can be? I think he is. I think he can be. But we haven't seen that. You know, he's been out. So what's really the future hold for that? That's the big question mark. And I think that's probably why, from the outside looking in, they might be a step behind right now. In reality, you know, 3 weeks in, he's playing well and they're winning games. It doesn't matter. Just look at the standings at that point. But you got in Houston, obviously, Stroud going into year two, all the weapons they kind of are building around him. And, of course, here in Jacksonville, with an offense that's solidified now, with a quarterback, with wide receivers, with a defense and some players on that. It does feel like Houston, Jacksonville, then Indy kind of a half step behind. And then Tennessee, who knows what's going to happen there with all the changes they've had. So that's at least my view going in. But again, like if Houston or excuse me, if Indianapolis comes out of the gates early, that changes the whole dynamic. 3 weeks in, you know, come October, we're talking about Indy rolling in this thing early. Like, all you got to do is go out and play well, and if the quarterback is there and doing that, then that changes the whole dynamic.
What are you expecting? JP Shadrick joins us. What are you expecting in terms of day two selections, wiggle room, areas that will still need to be addressed if they are at that point more comfortable with taking a swing at a luxury pick like a wide receiver, because we've talked about how deep that is, or maybe addressing another area of key need? What does day two shape up like in Jacksonville?
Yeah, Jaguars have, I think, the 48th pick, so it's a little deeper down in that second round. So they've got a couple of fourth-round picks they can play with. They need to package something and maybe move up a few spots to get something. You know, like I said, if it's, you know, if they go corner first, I still think you got to think about the future at the outside of the offensive line. Anton Harrison can play left tackle, but he is the right tackle last year. What does the future hold there? Can he swing back over to left if you draft a right tackle, a true right tackle? And then maybe you figure out, you know, do you still want to play with Cam Robinson or move him? Or, you know, Walker Little's going into his last year. So there's big questions there. Wide receiver, I think, probably certainly could be in play for the Jaguars there in the second round because, you know, like we said, you don't need a true number one guy to trade up and go get, but it's a deep wide receiver class. And it feels like these wide receiver classes are going to be like this for the years to come, just the way college football is played now. So you're going to have skilled wide receivers and guys that can go play for you. But it's just a matter of that IQ part again. So that, for me, it's, you know, probably offensive line, wide receiver, if it's not corner in the first round, and then go from there. After that, it's a crapshoot. I mean, it is best available, and I think they've done enough in free agency to fill enough holes to be able to go play. So you're looking at depth at that point, and, you know, what kind of numbers do you have for the future?
JP, my following question I'm asking from a how it affects the Colts standpoint, and I'll explain what I mean by that with your answer, and that is, how much does Jacksonville use Trevor Lawrence's legs and his ability to get outside the pocket? Because in college he did that a lot, but do they take advantage of that at all?
They did some last year. You know, now some of that too is just the way he runs. He's not necessarily a thick runner, if you will. Like, he's not going to run to contact. He's not. They don't sneak a lot. You know, I mean, he'll do that jump over the line kind of sneak.
But they don't do design draws with him, right?
It didn't feel like that. Now they'll do some of that read option stuff. They did some of that last year. They didn't shove it down your throat all the time, but a couple, three times a game they'd mix it in and he would keep it and run for a key first down, you know, and slide down after about 8 yards. That was kind of the idea. But the problem with Trevor has been ball protection, holding on to the football and fumbling and when he's in open field running. Like, fumbling, just dropping the football, like not even getting hit. So that's been really the concern with him. When he gets out and runs sometimes, he can be a little careless with the football, and he's got to be cleaner. And, yeah, he does have the ability to run and do that. I don't think, especially, obviously, if they pay him all this money at some point, which they might, you know, you don't want him running around and taking hits. Well, and so he's got to do a better job of getting down, protecting the ball, because they do use that sometimes, the running game for the quarterback.
The reason I ask it is because I do think that teams draft sometimes based on having to play against what they know is, you know, like within the division. Like, I really do think that the Colts, for example, when they had Peyton Manning, you know, they made a concerted effort to go out and get really good edge rushers because they knew teams were going to have to pass against them playing from behind more often than
true,
not, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah,
so
yeah.
If you are Indianapolis, you're looking at, okay, we have a lead, you know, in C.J. Stroud within the division where we're going to have some flexibility on our defensive line to be able to get after mobile quarterback. And yet you wonder with Lawrence, do they kind of attack the same way with Trevor Lawrence? Because if you're Jacksonville, you can pretty much look at it and say, we have to have a defensive line that can go against mobile quarterbacks because you're seeing Stroud, you're seeing Richardson, who theoretically is going to be the same, and I guess maybe Levis remains to be seen. But I was curious what the Colts may strategize in terms of what they're going to see within the division, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm with you. And it's not certainly the mobility of Richardson. That's not what Trevor's ever going to be. I mean – but he does have something. He's not Dan Marino, right? He's not standing back there like a statue.
Right.
He's able to kind of move around, move the pocket if needed. And, yes, the read option game is in play. Now, their number one priority is to pass football. They're not going to sit back there and fool you and try to do that all the time. They're going to be more pass and run. And, you know, but when they have to strategically, they will mix it in. And that's pretty much the Trevor Lawrence game.
JP, we've talked about this from the Colts' perspective, and I think we talked about it with you a little bit during our last conversation at the convention center during the combine. So much of a general manager's job today, yes, it is focusing internally, building within, building to your blueprint, your game plan, not worrying about what's happening outside your walls. But we saw last year to some extent the other teams in the division, the Texans, the Colts, and the Titans, realizing that, A, from their internal timelines, it was time to go get a quarterback because, look, in division, the best quarterback is currently Trevor Lawrence. This is an arms race. Look around the AFC. This is what needs to happen. And so reactionary moves, albeit beneficial to internal goals, wind up happening. From the Jaguars' standpoint, how much of, let's say they take Tyrion Arnold out of Alabama, just in a hypothetical, because I think a lot of people have him high up on one of the best corners in this draft. How much of that is both, because the Colts could say the same thing, is both a clear need that needs to be addressed while also realizing both in division, and we'll keep it there for the sake of our market, in division, oh, it's it's Stephon Diggs now that's paired up there with C.J. Stroud. How much of that is reactionary while also achieving internal goals?
I think that's the perfect scenario, right? I mean, it's somebody you need anyway. And, I mean, just look at the firepower they have in Houston now. You mentioned Diggs, but the other guys they have there, Tank Dell and all these players that can run. I mean, these guys can fly. So you got to go get guys that can defend some of that. Now, part of it, the other argument is, okay, is it more pass rush? Does that help the corners? The corners will tell you otherwise, depending on who the corner is. If the corner helps the pass rush out, I mean, that's just the perspective. But they feel like they have some pass rush here now, obviously, with Josh Allen re-signed and Trayvon Walker to help out some of those corners. But you still need top-end guys. And, I mean, this organization in the past, and now this is the distant past, has not had great results from first-round cornerbacks here. They've only done it three times. Fernando Bryant was back in 99. I was still in high school. It's a long time ago. and then, of course, Jalen Ramsey was, the pick. He was the one to pick. It didn't work out here because of some things off the field, and he wanted out and got out of here. And then C.J. Henderson was just the wrong pick, and he didn't even make it and got traded about a year or two in. So they've got to have a guy that hits. And if you start having to restock those first-round corners that you had here, then you're just doubling down. And that not just at that position they've had issues in the first round, but getting those guys to the second contract is just going to struggle around here over the years. And but especially the corner position. They've tried to backfill that a couple of times and have been unsuccessful. So if you're going to slow down those guys in the division twice a year, you got to have top-tier guys to match their top-tier guys. There's no doubt.
You know, I was just thinking about this, JP, and I don't know if you can do this. So we might have to do this quietly, which is not a good idea to discuss on radio. But okay. Jim Irsay's got this contest, right? If you can predict the Colts' schedule exactly, then he's going to give you $1 million, okay? Now, if you get any sort of intel ahead of the release on when the Jaguars' Colts games are going to be, and I can chalk those in, and then I win the million, then I'll owe you roughly 12% because that's 12% of the schedule. So, and then I've just got to do this with a couple of other people, and we're good to go. Now, can I chalk you in for this?
It sounds like I need more than 12 because the risk, there's a lot of risk in my place. So we're looking towards like 25.
Well, now, wait a minute. But then I'm going to run out of money because if I got to ask the Houston folk to do the same, right?
That's a you problem. That's not a me problem.
But here's the thing. No, but here's the thing. I just, and again, this is the way my brain works. You and the folks in Houston, you got no state income tax, so I don't owe you as much because you're going to skate a little bit more than me, right? Because I'm going to have to pay a little bit on this. So we're down
to reporting this. I don't know we're reporting this.
We're not. That's true. Well, here's the thing. It's going to be well documented if we win. Right? If I win, right? So now all of a sudden I'm going to have to report it.
Well,
so that's
this conversation never happened.
Believe you me. And if you see, and believe me, if you see our ratings, you're right, right? I can assure you.
In all seriousness, though, we won't know. I mean, schedule's what, early May usually the last few years they've been doing that?
Yeah.
So we really don't have an inkling at all until right there the day of. So your guess is as good as mine right now. I will say, though, they've done a pretty good job the last few years of putting key divisional games in the last 3 weeks of the season, at least a couple of them. You know, two of the last three or three of the last four sometimes are divisional games late in December, early January. And that's what it's all about come the last quarter of the season. So you probably at least ink one of those in there, I would guess.
Colts are going to open against the Jags at home. Hmm. And then they're going to play the Jags in Jacksonville in Week 16.
I mean, it's not far-fetched. You know?
Just going with it. I'm going with it. And here's the thing. I've already written you out. You just said that you're not helping out with this project. So when I win the million, buddy, I'll come down there and hang out and listen to Leonard Skinner, but you ain't getting a cut.
I gave you a good idea of when they could be, just based
that's
on
true.
Past history.
All right. How about this? I'll buy your drinks at Locals. How's that?
Good deal.
All right. Sounds good. Always a pleasure, JP. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
JP Shadrick, again, Jaguars.com down in Jacksonville. Jacksonville would be a cool place to live. Good weather, lots of beaches. If you like coffee, the whole city smells like it. You listen to some Leonard Skinner.
Get to shout Duval randomly.
That's right. It's cool. I like Jacksonville. Jacksonville's cool. And it's kind of like it's more Georgia than Florida to some extent. Some will fight you over that, but it's cool.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
So, Eddie, you have run the math. The odds of nailing the 17-game schedule for the Colts that Jim Irsay is going to pay at $1 million for, there are how many combinations?
So you have 18, technically, because you have to factor in the bye week in all of this. So you have 18 weeks, not 17.
Okay.
It is, I'm hoping I'm getting this correct, 6 quintillion, 402 quadrillion, 373 trillion, 705 billion, 728. Oh, sorry, I got it all wrong. I got to redo it. Hold on. In my mind, I had it right. Mm-hmm. I skipped over. Because you have
I believe, is the answer, Jake.
And that's only going to pay $1 million if you nail that?
Again, going back to you fighting for the common man, the size of the task does not match the size of the price.
It's 6 quadrillion, 402 trillion, 373 billion, 705 million, 728,000.
Very good. It's not bad. Just imagine if you get one. If you get within one, you should get something, right? Pacers have better odds in game two, let's hope.
That's correct.
Joining us now to talk about it from Bally Sports Television. Of course, you see him doing sidelines pre- and post-game as well with Eddie Gill. Jeremiah Johnson joins us on the show. JJ, I will begin with this question, and that is, from your standpoint in preparation for this game, do we have any more information regarding Giannis and his availability for Milwaukee?
I don't want to get off topic, but was quadrillion a number that was referenced? Because I would have no idea how many zeros that is.
It's quad. It's five quad, zeros,
quad,
right?
Quadrillion. Wow.
Here's the thing, Jeremiah, and I'm going to fill
you in. My dad was a math teacher, and I don't recall that number ever being mentioned or seen with my own eyes.
Well, here's what's weird. Eddie went out to Seattle, Eddie Garrison, right? He went out to Seattle.
He saw Bezos.
And then Eddie came back from Seattle, and he was eating these gummy bears and Sour Patch Kids for like 3 days, and he's been smiling but not making any sense at all ever since. So I'm not really certain what's going on there, right?
Well, so he found my phone number, and he texted me this morning, so at least he's accomplishing the task of the job.
Listen, it took him 45 minutes to send that text. It's very odd.
All right. Well, to your original question, Giannis Antetokounmpo, not quite as long of a name or as quadrillion or a number. Doubtful was what the injury report designated on Sunday, but Doc Rivers said he really had not done anything in practice with the team. He's listed as doubtful for this game. Just listening to them talk about him, it did not sound as though there was any expectation from Milwaukee's side of things that they were planning on him for game two. I suppose you have to be ready for anything, but I'm going to believe the doubtful designation and say it's unlikely he'll play tonight.
JJ, do you think they have identified what went wrong? I know there was a multitude of factors that cost them game one, but do you feel like now, roughly 48 hours removed, that they have properly identified root cause?
Well, it's more like what you said at the beginning. There were a multitude of factors, and it's not just one thing. Defensively, their coverages, they have a system, and they're planning to attack the Bucks in a certain way, and they didn't do that in the first half. No, they made some changes and adjustments in the second half, but it's not like what they did in the second half was necessarily exactly what they wanted to do to start the game. They had to adjust because of what Damian Lillard did. However, what they weren't doing, how they were not really communicating, led to some of the situations where he either had some good looks or there were some times Bucks were driving to the basket and you didn't have much resistance or help. And that's the defense you saw maybe in the first part of the season, not once they changed things. And then offensively, you know, so many times when you ask a question about offense, it goes back to defense more with the Pacers than some teams because they don't want to get in a half-court execution game. They're good at that, or they're okay with that, I should say, because they can pass the ball around the perimeter and try to get the open looks. But they want to start with some pace and getting out and going and getting across half-court in, you know, less than 4 seconds and then beating the other team down the court. When you don't get those stops, you're taking that out of the net, and then you're getting that pressure from Milwaukee extended even beyond half court. They're getting the ball out of Tyrese Halliburton's hands. They didn't adjust well to that. Now, they've seen that kind of defense throughout the season. Go back to December when every game teams were trying to take the ball out of Tyrese Halliburton's hands. So this should not be something that is new. Maybe a little surprising that the Bucks went there from the opening tip in game one, but I think they'll be ready to make those adjustments in game two.
Was Tyrese Halliburton too passive in game one?
Well, far be it from me to say, but it did seem like you wanted a little more aggressiveness, and I think he acknowledged as much. I don't know that he said that, you know, I should have shot more, but he simply said he needed to be better. But I think there's kind of an understanding that your best player needs to be just more impactful. I think they were a little too passive offensively. When he got the ball out of his hands, there wasn't enough of an effort to get it back to him. If they're going to double him and someone else gets the ball, then that's going to create an opportunity where you can continue to move it around and maybe get it back to him. They're not going to keep the two players on him while he stands. So at some point, you've got to have some second action where he gets it back and you're looking to get him more shots. And Pascal Siakam shouldered a heavy load and he did a really good job, but he needs more help. I mean, that's exactly what Tyrese Halliburton told me yesterday. Is that, you know, Pascal played great, hit some tough mid-range twos, but we need to do more to help him out. And I just could tell in the brief comments that he shared on Sunday, then after practice yesterday, what happened in game one does not sit well with him. He's not someone who's going to react to everything that's said about him, but I think he's aware, and he didn't need to read or hear anything from, you know, reporters or fans or anyone else to know he needed to make a bigger imprint on game one, and I think he'll have a determined look from the opening tip tonight.
Jeremiah Johnson is our guest, talking about the Pacers and Milwaukee Bucks game two in the Eastern Conference playoffs. Listen, JJ, I'm not trying to put you in a position of like, let's sit here and just have like a complain fest about Indiana. I mean, I think we know that game one was disappointing, but there were a couple of players that you would have liked to have seen get jump started more that we've seen good minutes from. McConnell comes to mind, Toppin comes to mind. But dude, you've been around this team all year. When they've had games like that, they've had to bounce back from. Does it become schematic changes from Rick Carlisle, or is it more so just, hey, you know what, wipe the edge of sketch clean, let's go back to the drawing board? What just kind of has been their way of addressing these sorts of bounce backs?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the words that you hear from the assistant coaches when I talk with them at halftime of games, you talk about force, physicality. You can tell when the guys are defending and they're really just sort of getting in the space of the guy they're defending, but showing their hands, because the key is you got to be physical without fouling. They didn't just apply enough pressure on the defensive end, and then that led them to trying to do a little bit too much offensively. The bench is a question mark that I wasn't sure either way entering the season, the series, because it's not usually as big a factor in the postseason, but much like pace, when they say the game slows down, I wonder sometimes, does it have to be a big difference? Now, the second unit just did not have that spark and that impact that you wanted to see, that you saw all season. I think that maybe in shorter stints, I think you'll see T.J. McConnell and Obi Toppin play better. But you're still in a playoff series. You're going to rely on your stars, and Pascal Siakam did everything you would have asked him to do. Even Miles Turner probably wishes some of those early shots he had that he could have them back, because everyone was missing long, and a lot of the misses up and down the roster from guys that are shooting high 30% from three, even to 40%, they just weren't close. So they really, you know, up and down, with the exception of Pascal Siakam, no one was in any kind of rhythm. And I still say it gets back to playing with a little more edge on the defensive end, and then everything else can take care of itself. So, I mean, look for early on in that first quarter, look for guys to just literally try to find out the flavor of chewing gum of Damian Lillard, to borrow a line from Gene Hackman. I mean, you just want to be all over him. You can't foul, and you got to be careful, because he's a vet and he's tricky. And if you have your hands anywhere on him, he's going to try to get that shot up. But refs will let you be more physical. You have to take advantage of that.
Jeremiah Johnson is our guest, covers the Pacers for Bally Sports. JJ, Ben Shepherd, and again, blame can be thrown around altogether. No one really shot the ball well outside of Siakam. Ben Shepherd looked like a rookie in game one. That said, he's made great strides in the second half of the season, to the point I'm not drastically worried about him. But from your standpoint, how do you reassure the rookie, keep that confidence going? Because he's going to be a big part of this series in the minutes that he gets.
I at least like that there was no hesitation from his shots. And it wasn't like he was hitting everything he shot in the regular season. So for at least the way he got his shots and the rhythm that he had, I didn't notice a big difference. There were other guys I did feel like hesitated just a little bit and weren't as quick to shoot it. Again, you know, a question about Obi Toppin or T.J. McConnell or Ben Shepherd, you want those guys to all do a little bit more, but this is a game that's about the guys that are, you know, going to play 35, 36, 40 minutes, the guys that are, you know, getting the bigger paychecks. So for as much as you want from Ben Shepherd, you just need him to come in. If he hits a shot or he makes a defensive play or he dives on the floor for a loose ball, that can help get you fired up. It still needs to be, you know, Aaron Nesmith hitting those shots and getting the stops and getting out and running and maybe getting a little bit more from Andrew Nembhard. So it was good for Ben Shepherd to get that game of playoff experience under his belt. But again, the good thing was I felt like he didn't hesitate at all. His game in the playoffs wasn't that much different to me than maybe I saw in the last month of the regular season.
You know what always drove me nuts, Jeremiah, and Hoosiers, is Buddy's given that task to find out what flavor gum the guy chews, right?
Yeah.
And then his answer is Dentine. Well, that's not a flavor. It's just a brand. Flavor. Right,
I think he might have been. Isn't cinnamon like the original Dentine, even though it's not technically original? It's the one that most people know about.
I think that's probably right. I just, like, I thought that was like kind of taking the easy way out there, right? I mean, like, you don't like. I mean, you could just assume the guy's chewing Dentine, but you could be playing, you know, Halliburton defense and be able to and still not know the flavor, right? I mean, you got to get up in the grill. I mean, you got to be Andrew Nembhard to get that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you want to say, like, you know, bubble yum watermelon, right?
Right.
Exactly.
It always drove me nuts. It was like a writing flaw in the movie. It really bothered me. Have you done anything fun in Milwaukee? Did you go to Best Place and get a PBR?
No. I saw the Fon statue. I figured you'd ask.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
Milwaukee. It wasn't that far off the beaten path, but I walked along the river a little bit. Met some of my colleagues and watched a little of the Knicks. Sixers game last night. Had a little spotted cow, which is only in Wisconsin, correct?
Yes.
That is correct, yep.
Yep. Yuengling, you know, you only could get Yuengling certain places. Now you can get it everywhere. Spotted cow, you can only get in Wisconsin.
Love so, a good spotted cow.
I had one of those. Yep.
You know, when last time we were in Milwaukee, we went to Lakefront Brewing Company, which is like a microbrew place. And that's where they filmed the opening scene of Laverne and Shirley, where Laverne and Shirley put their gloves on the bottles and they take off, and then it later shows them waiting for the gloves to come back around. So we do the tour, and they say, like, oh, this is where the Laverne and Shirley scene was. And they pick Shannon and I to go up there and be the Laverne and Shirley to do the glove thing and reenact the whole thing. And we do it, and it's fun, and I'm, of course, thrilled that we're the two that picked. And then we get back to the hotel, and Shannon says, that was really fun, but I got to be honest, why did they have us do that glove thing? And I'm like, well, wait a minute, the whole point, the Laverne and Shirley thing, are you kidding me? And then she's like, oh, that's right. I, you know, but it was that's your project. Next time you're in Milwaukee, because you don't have time tonight, but you got to go back, do the glove thing, and then you'll know why you're doing it. I'm just saying.
Well, the hope is that the Pacers are back for game five. They just at least need to win one to force that, and no time like the present. But I will say that I'm planning on being back in Brew City or Cream City, two of the nicknames we've heard used since our time here this weekend. We're planning to be back next weekend.
No, I think you know, look, let's face it. I'm almost sure that you will, JJ, but... And can we assume, and this is simply an assumption, I will say that to protect both of us here, but I assume, as I'm sure you do as well, that if you are back in Milwaukee, that at that point you probably are calling and talking about a game that Giannis is on, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder how much the Bucks' status in the series would play into that. So let's say it was 3-1 and Would they continue to try to hold him out? Really, that's something I don't know. I think you'll know a lot by what happens on Thursday for the Bucks, because, again, with him not really practicing legitimately, like practicing, not just going to practice and getting up shots, that made it – you have a pretty good idea games one and two were out of the question. You'll have a travel day. You'll have probably a day off for both teams on Wednesday, and then – Thursday is a practice day, and so I'll be interested to hear and see, does Giannis practice on Thursday? And if he doesn't, to me, it makes it more unlikely that he plays in those games at Gainbridge Fieldhouse. But with Cavs, you don't want to risk it. You don't want to injure something else, and he is worth much more than to this franchise than just this series. So we'll have to wait and see. Some of that could just depend on how things go in the next few games.
I'm telling you, if you're the Pacers, you just want Doc Rivers to be up 3-1, and then it's like, let's go. Let's go. Numbers are on our side. Jeremiah, enjoy Milwaukee and appreciate the conversation, and hopefully it'll be 1-1 when we come back here, but we shall see. That's why they play the games.
All right. Always enjoy the time. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it. Jeremiah Johnson from Bally Sports talking about the Pacers, and, you know, he said Cavs, and I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute, Cleveland also. And then I'm like, that's right, it's his calf, right?
Yep. Yeah. Verbiage and enunciation is key there.